Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is our friend Casey Seiler, state editor and Capital Bureau chief for the Albany Times-Union and one of the hosts of Public Television's New York Now, a statewide political program. Welcome back, Casey.
Alan, great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So you're on your way down to the conventions. You'll be going to the conventions. They're almost on our doorstep. What kind of role will New York play in all of this?
Well, this is the first presidential election in, what, six decades where both of the major party nominees are New Yorkers. You know, yeah. New Yorkers, certainly in Donald Trump's case, nobody's more New York-y than him, I think we could probably argue, or at least downstate-y. And in the case of Hillary Clinton, you've got somebody who for the last decade and a half plus has been an adopted New Yorker. And of course, New York tends to like its adopted New Yorkers because so many of us, including myself, come from someplace else.
Where do you come from?
Born in Buffalo, actually.
Well, that's certainly outside of New York City.
No. Okay, born in Buffalo, but when I was five, my family moved away and headed south. So 2.5 years in West Virginia, and then did most of my growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, which is where my parents are still based.
Are they into horses?
They are, I think, no is the short answer. They enjoy going to the track, but they are not in horses in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, so you're uniquely qualified to speak about, you know, the New York state of mind, because while you were born here and you have those New York genes, you also, have a different, you know, vantage point. So Donald Trump, of course, has no chance, even though he's a great New Yorker, even though the skating rink in Central Park is named after him, the carousel is named after him, but he has no chance of winning in New York State, right?
Probably not.
Probably.
Well,
I'll meet you in Macy's window if he wins in New York State.
We're talking in early July, so you got to remember that anything can happen in this great world. As we learned just this week with the FBI's no indictment recommendation for Hillary Clinton, things can change in whipsaw speed in national politics, without a doubt. All of the polls suggest that Donald Trump has a very, very steep hill to climb in New York. New York is a blue state. Democrats outnumber Republicans by a significant number. Now, what Trump has told me in an interview we had back before the state primary was that no, Republicans always ignore New York. He's not going to ignore New York. He is a known quantity here. He's been a media figure here for decades, which is absolutely true, and he thinks he can make inroads. I think even Republicans suggest that his energies and his money and the money of the Republican apparatus is probably going to be better spent elsewhere in swing states.
So, Casey, I've gone to many, many conventions over the years, and I always sort of wonder, what the heck do the delegates do when they get down there? I mean, what did they do? The party platform, you hold up your hand, somebody tells you what to say. It's got to be somewhat futile to try to cover all of this non-happening.
Well, these are the first national conventions that I've ever been to. Oh. I've been covering politics for about 8 years now.
Better you than me.
Yeah, 4 years ago, the Times Union, the Capital Bureau sent Jimmy Vielkind, who's now with Politico, to both conventions. He did great work down there. 4 years before that, in 2008, it was my colleague Irene J. Liu, who is now over in Hong Kong covering Asia, doing great work as well. So this time they're sending the old guy.
You're not an old guy. I'm an old guy. So my question is, what will you do when you get down here?
I'm going to be sticking as close as possible to the state delegation to find out what exactly it will mean. Who is going to go from, for example, the Senate Republican Conference, the state Senate Republican Conference, that is? What is it going to mean to be at the convention or to not be at the convention for example, Senate candidates who are running in really tight districts? Are they going to be running into the arms of Donald Trump because this is going to be Donald Trump's convention, or are they going to be running away from it? You know, what is Wendy Long, who is running against Chuck Schumer, another kind of uphill race, I think it's fair to say. She definitely is up against it, as she was up against it when she ran against Kirsten Gillibrand. You know, what is she going to try to do to use...
She's what we call a long shot.
I think that's fair to say, a long shot, yes. What is she going to do to use the convention as a trampoline? Is the convention going to be a trampoline for these candidates or a trapdoor? And I think that depends in large part on what happens at the convention. Also, what's happening outside the convention in terms of protests. We know that the kind of anti-Trump forces are going to be coming heavy in Cleveland, without a doubt. And one would imagine that the forces allied against Hillary Clinton are going to show up in Philadelphia and make their presence known as well.
I'm so old that I remember the 1972 convention with Richard Nixon. And I remember all kinds of tear gas and everything else going on around the place.
Was that Miami?
Yeah, Miami.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll see that again.
It remains to be seen. I think there's going to be plenty of excitement at this convention, plenty of pressing questions, political questions, without a single punch having to be thrown. We've seen violence happen over the course of this election cycle. So far, I don't think it's...
Guy gets into trouble at a Republican thing or something like that. I mean, this is not exactly violence.
I think it's fair to say that there has been isolated incidents of what you would constitute as violence, you know, shouted words that turn into punches thrown. There certainly hasn't been anything on the scale of, you know, Chicago 68 at the Democratic National Convention to date, but it remains to be seen. I've been checking in on websites, on social media, with some of the groups that are going to be showing up that are already saying, hey, help us out with funds to pay for food for protesters in Cleveland and that type of thing. So there are going to be protests, as there are at every national convention. Whether or not they turn ugly remains to be seen.
Our guest is Casey Seiler, state editor and Capitol Bureau chief for the Albany Times Union and one of the hosts of Public Television's New York Now. Okay. Casey, you, of course, are an expert on our governor, Governor Cuomo.
And he would probably argue with that description.
Yeah, he probably would argue with anybody about any description. Yeah. So my question to you is this. I sort of see this in my dreams. Andrew Cuomo, that is, standing up in the middle of a circle. And around that circle, you get a whole bunch of people who are being seriously, and I mean seriously, investigated by not only the United States Attorney, Pete Barrera, but by the State Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, who many people thought was by this time an ally of the governor. How many people can be under suspicion of having done something wrong standing around you in that circle without somebody saying, hey, how could this be that everybody who's around them is potentially corrupt, but he's not?
Well, some would say that's guilt by association, and others would say that you've got to take these cases one by one. And at this point, we're talking about three individuals over the course of two investigations. And in the case of the federal investigation that's currently ongoing from the Office of the Southern District of the U.S. Attorney's Office, Preet Bharara, it's an investigation into what has been described by the administration as potential conflicts of interest and improper lobbying in upstate development projects. The two individuals that appear to be at the center of that investigation are Joe Prococo, the governor's former top aide, deputy executive secretary, I believe is the term, longtime friend of the governor, going back to his father's administration, who left the administration over the course of the last year. What's in question is what exactly Joe Prococo did for private development firms that had business before the state during a 7-month period in 2014 when he was not collecting a public paycheck. He was rather working, managing the governor's reelection campaign. And he was also, according to his disclosure forms, working for a firm called CHA, which is based in Albany, and a firm out in Syracuse that also has extensive development dealings. That firm claims that it never paid him. So that's being looked at. Both of these firms that paid Prococo were clients of Todd Howe. And Todd Howe is yet another longtime Cuomo associate who he worked with at the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, and once again worked with him in his father's administration, in the administration of Mario Cuomo. Todd Howe became a lobbyist with a large and very powerful Albany-based law firm. He was kind of their Washington guy. And then over the course of recent years, he took on a lot of development clients, upstate development clients. What he exactly did for them and whether it crossed over into improper lobbying is apparently, because of course the U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't talk about these things at all while an investigation is going on, the feds are trying to find out if anything improper happened and exactly what the relationship was between Todd Howe and Joe Prococo. Todd Howe, it has been reported that...
Well, he got fired from that law firm.
He got fired from the law firm in the wake of the investigation.
Yeah.
And the Howe Prococo investigation is the subject of a large and wide-ranging subpoena that was dropped on the administration in late April. The administration then made the decision to hire their own investigator to look into this matter, a guy named Bart Schwartz.
Now, that's with public money?
Yes, with public money. The Bart Schwartz investigation, which is still cloaked in a lot of mystery, is being paid for by taxpayers. Now, the governor said 6 weeks ago that the contract with Bart Schwartz, between Bart Schwartz and his office, was being finalized and that it
would be... That's the publicly financed contract.
Exactly.
To investigate themselves, even though they were being investigated by the U.S. attorney.
Right. And that contract, although it was being finalized 6 weeks ago, is still in the wind. Also in the wind is a set of guidelines that Bart Schwartz is apparently going to use to serve as the de facto controller for the self-same upstate development projects that are now under investigation. In other words, Schwartz is the guy who needs to sign off on large disbursements of money, and these are big disbursements of money. $500 million went out the door in June.
Is there any conflict of interest here for Bart Schwartz and for New Yorkers who are watching this happen? After all, he's been hired to be an investigator of potential misdeeds within the Cuomo administration.
What?
At the same time, they've given him a hands-on role in dispersing money.
That's a very good question. One other thing that New Yorkers might want to know about is the fact that Bart Schwartz has been given civil subpoena power by the administration, by the governor, under the Moreland Act. And that is something that nobody knew until just about 2 weeks ago. And I'm happy to say that I was the one who first reported it.
Yes, because, you did. I was very proud of you.
But thank you. But before that, there had been news stories that said Schwartz will not have subpoena power. Schwartz's investigation is going to be hindered by the fact that he won't have subpoena power. At no point did the administration, or Bart Schwartz for that matter, move to correct these stories.
Okay, a couple of things. Moreland Act, doesn't that have a sort of familiar ring to it? The governor had a corruption-fighting group that he put together with some very distinguished district attorneys and others on it. They all got deputized by the state attorney general, Eric Schneiderman, so that they could go where they wanted. And then inexplicably, the governor sort of closed it all down, saying he could do whatever he wanted. It was his own commission, and he really got a black eye, and frankly, he deserved it.
The great wound in his first term, or really in his entire term right now, was the premature shutdown of the Moreland Commission as part of a political deal that he reached with Dean Skelos and Sheldon Silver in 2014.
Well, that's what he says. I know there was a supposed political deal. He got some stuff out of them.
There was absolutely a political deal.
Well, some of the investigations that were going on by that Moreland group apparently were reaching some of the very real estate industry that was funneling money to different people. So you may say the motivation was that he was making a deal with Skelos and with Shelley Silver, both, by the way, on the way to the Who's Got right now.
Yeah.
But it also may be that something else was going on that got the governor.
That the governor was afraid that it was reaching too close, the investigations.
Yes, we're reaching too close into his administration.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. But I think the larger problem, there was the problem of the embarrassment that those investigations might have brought to him. I think the larger problem was that the Moreland Commission was causing him political difficulties in dealing with the legislature. You have to remember that the commission was shut down at the very end of the budget negotiation in 2014. So in addition to an ethics package that everybody, except for the governor probably, agreed was fairly lackluster in 2014.
Yeah, yeah.
The governor also got other agenda items that he was looking for in 2014, and Skelos and Silver were able to go back to their members and say the Moreland Commission has been put to bed permanently and a pillow put over its face.
Well, you are my guest. But we do have a difference of opinion.
But that is the official story.
But the bottom
line is, if you're looking for an explanation as to why the administration was very, very, very quiet about giving Bart Schwartz Moreland Act powers, it's because they did not want a headline of, uh-oh, Andrew Cuomo is using the Moreland Act again. And you have to remember that when the Moreland Commission was shut down and questions were asked about the Moreland Commission's investigation of the second floor, meeting the governor, Cuomo came back and said, any investigation staffed and organized by the executive branch cannot look at the executive branch because it would not pass the laugh test. Now, Bart Schwartz's investigation, it was not organized or staffed by the governor, but it is hired on and contracted by the governor's office, and it is directly looking at issues that go right to the heart. I mean, literally to Joe Prococo, who was the governor's closest aide in many ways, certainly one of his five closest aides, without a doubt.
So now I wanted to get to Eric Schneiderman.
Yeah.
Now, Eric Schneiderman and the governor have had a very interesting relationship.
Tendentious at times.
Tendentious. Tender. And we know that the governor, when he took over as governor, came from the attorney generalship, and he wanted to take with him some of the responsibilities that had gotten him so far as attorney general, and Schneiderman said, no, this is my job, this is what I get. Can you fill us in on that?
Well, this governor clearly sees any other pool of power, being it political or investigative around the state, as being a potential threat to him. If you look at other people that have significant independent powers around the state, Tom DiNapoli, Bill de Blasio, New York City mayor, and Eric Schneiderman, these are three guys who the governor has not always had a very good relationship
with. Put away another way.
Exactly.
They're not me, therefore they're bad.
Yeah, they're not me, and they have power, so something must be done. Now, they've worked together on things, and of course, Schneiderman was called in by the governor to deputize, to name as deputy attorneys general, many members of the Moreland Commission who were attorneys, who were prosecutors, no less.
So it was supposed to be both of theirs, but it turned out that when Cuomo KO'd the Moreland Act Commission, we didn't hear much from Schneiderman.
No, it was egg. There was egg on Schneiderman's face.
Yes, and he was embarrassed.
Right, and Schneiderman, from what we are given to understand, answered questions that were put forward by Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney, about exactly what happened with the Moreland Commission. Bharara, of course, came to the conclusion that there was no evidence of a prosecutable crime in the Cuomo administration's alleged meddling with the Moreland Commission on
public corruption. Not sufficient evidence.
Correct.
Sufficient is a sort of interesting word.
So what this is all leading up to is the fact that Schneiderman has now indicted a gentleman named Steve Pidgeon.
Uh-huh.
Steve Pidgeon is a longtime political fixer, consultant, and attorney whose base is in Western New York, but whose acts have ranged widely across the state. He served as a kind of aide-de-camp to billionaire Tom Golisano, Western New York kind of tycoon who kind of tried to become a political power broker, was talked about as being gubernatorial material, but who now kind of famously decided that he was going to move his base of operations to Florida so he wouldn't have to pay such fat New York taxes. Tom Golisano and Steve Pidgeon were among the half dozen guys who were the architects of the June 2009 Senate coup, which ended 6 years ago this week. Oh, it takes me back. Where they tried to use the two most disreputable members of the Senate Democratic Conference, tried to flip their loyalties in that narrowly divided chamber, and Republicans tried to take over the chamber, and it almost worked. They signed up Pedro Espada Jr., a real—
Where is he right now?
He's in a federal facility.
Oh, yeah.
I believe in Brooklyn. He used to be in Pennsylvania, but he stepped over the line quite literally down there. And so I believe that when last heard from, he was in the federal pokey in Brooklyn. And Hiram Montserrat was the other one. Montserrat,
where's he right now?
I think he's out now. I'm not quite sure. But ultimately, he came a cropper for his campaign spending. Yeah. But Hiram Montserrat at the time was facing charges. I think he had been found guilty of misdemeanor assault on his girlfriend. So anyway, Steve Pidgeon, after the coup, went to go work for Pedro Espada, and then he just went back to Buffalo, and he became sort of a leading political consultant. Eric Schneiderman, late June, brought charges against the state Supreme Court justice, and that gentleman pleaded guilty to accepting bribes from Pigeon and filing false documents to kind of cover up the fact that he had taken Pigeon's advice on a guy to hire for a receivership. And then the very next day, Pigeon pleaded not guilty to 9 felony counts of trying to bribe a judge. And Pigeon is a guy who was ally of the governor in 2002 when he first ran for governor and got defeated roundly. And apparently in 2014, he was consulted. And what the administration now says is, yeah, we talked to Steve Pigeon, but we talked to lots of people, that he was not some kind of Western.
So all these guys who are close to Cuomo are always pushed away and said, well, we didn't really talk to our number
wasn't a,
one.
Wasn't a close friend of mine.
We weren't a close friend of mine. Yeah. And we didn't really talk to him and all like that. Casey Seiler, there's something called the Startup New York program. The state has invested millions of dollars into this. And there have been some embarrassing reports about what those millions have gotten for upstate New York in terms of new jobs as promised by the governor.
Well, this is the program that was previously known as Tax-Free New York. And basically what it says is if you're a company that wants to come and create jobs, if you base your operations on a certain set tracts of land, all of which are supposed to be connected to either SUNY or other public institutions, a couple of private institutions. Basically, what it means is that you would pay no taxes, no local, no corporate, no state, no nothing, and all of your employees could go for 10 years without paying state income taxes, which is a pretty good deal. Now, last year in 2014, the law that created it says there has to be an annual report, which is supposed to come out April 1st, that says how many jobs have been produced. Now, the first report in 2014 or for 2014 said that 86 jobs had been produced. That was roundly booed by critics of the program who describe it as a big boondoggle. Now, the 2015 report, which was supposed to be the first full year of operation by the program, supposed to come out April 1st. They delayed its release. They said, oh, we're just trying to make sure the information, the data is all correct. Finally, it came out on the Friday before the July 4th weekend, posted after 4 o'clock with no press release. Now, the only way to bury a report further than that is to quite literally dig a 6-foot deep hole and drop it down in there. But of course, reporters had been waiting for months for this. And what the report said is that the program created 332 jobs over the course of 2015.
How much is that a job?
Well, if you're talking about $55 million for the program, it is very, very, very expensive. But, of course, what the Empire State Development Corporation has said is that this is a long-term investment we're making. The money that we use to promote startup also promotes business friendliness upstate. But, you know, you can't, and they say, oh, these are good numbers. And then when asked why these numbers came out on the Friday afternoon before the holiday, they say, oh, we did it when it was done, and the director of the startup program is supposed to leave in a week. Now, we can't prove that they're lying, but the circumstantial evidence is all against them.
Sounds like they're lying.
Well, these are not good numbers. And, you know, the Times Union's editorial board and lots of other people have said it's time to take a really hard look at the startup program again and find out if the state is getting its money's worth.
Casey Seiler, thanks so much. Casey Seiler is, of course, state editor and Capitol Bureau chief for the Albany Times Union and one of the hosts of Public Television's New York Now, a statewide political program. Thanks again, Casey.
Thanks for having me on.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.